What's up, guys? Welcome to the Behind the Deal podcast, where we explore growth through acquisition. Whether you're a private equity fund manager looking to expand your portfolio or a business owner aiming to scale and build lasting value through acquisition, each of our episodes will break down the strategies, stories, the lessons that make acquisition one of the most powerful paths to growth. I hope you enjoy. In this episode of the Behind the Deal podcast, I talk to Todd Taske of Tower Partners. Todd's been a friend, you know, in this industry for the last 2 or 3 years. More than a friend, he's been a mentor. He's someone who I truly respect. He's one of the good guys in the space. He's someone who's helped Brian and I and Deal Gem Partners navigate through certain situations. He's someone who's helped us, you know, work on a few different deals that maybe we otherwise wouldn't have. He's someone who's helped us connect to buyers that we wouldn't have. But, you know, most of all, he's been someone who just knows the ropes of this M&A space, a great sell side banker, tremendous at what he does. Someone who every time I listen to him talk, or whether it's on a call with a client or just, you know, a one-on-one session I have with him, I learn something new. And I think he provided a lot of great value for this episode. So sit back and enjoy and learn a little bit more about, you know, the world of a sell side banker and what role we play within a transaction. Todd, good to see you, man. How you doing?
I am doing well, and I'm happy to be here. Joe, thanks for having me as a guest.
Me too. I'm very happy to have you as a guest. You know, you've been kind of a mentor and, you know, someone that, you know, Brian and I have looked up to since we've known you, and someone that we've been able to rely on for, you know, advice when we need it and just talking through different situations as, you know, someone who's seen a lot of them in your shoes. So I'm excited to be able to have you. I'm excited to have this conversation because most of the time I'm talking to people who are buying businesses. And in this instance, you know, we're going to be talking about the role that we play right in the middle, being that, you know, sell side or buy side investment banker between the company and the buyer. So giving the audience a unique perspective is something I'm looking forward to.
Me too, Joe. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, let's just jump right in, right? So I think, and I've noticed in my relatively short time doing this work, that there's a common misconception with business owners, founders who have built a business, you know, whether it's they've owned it for 5 years, 20 years, family owned business for 100 years, they know their business inside and out. They don't really exactly know what me and you do. And so there's a common misconception that, you know, our job is just simply to identify the right buyer for their business. When someone comes to you and they're saying, well, I think I already know somebody who might buy my business, or, you know, I've already been reached out to, you know, by a couple buyers, and I don't really think I need, you know, your help, or I don't really see the value here. What would your answer be to that question? How do you, how do guys like us actually add value?
You know, might sound self-serving, but there's a long list to that. Right. I'll give a specific example. I had a client, and by the way, as you know, Joe, we host a podcast called the Second Bite Podcast.
Yep.
So if you go to secondbitepodcast.com, you can check that out. And if you put in the search bar Mike Perez, you'll hear Mike tell this story. But Mike and I had known each other for a while. He had reached out to me and had a letter of intent from a group. And I think we talk about all the numbers on the podcast. The offer was for $55 million. And in that offer, he had a chunk of it as equity. He had two escrow accounts for a total of $8 million. He had a pretty tight non-compete. He had to leave all his software behind that he had developed on and on from that standpoint. So, and again, the episode will elaborate on it. The end result, he got $60 million for the business. He had zero in escrow because the buyer paid for rep and warrant insurance. Mm-hmm. So he got all the money distributed to him as cash. Mm-hmm. The equity piece he had a put right on for the either today's value or a value 3 years into the future, whatever's greater. He had a non-compete limited just to the vertical that he was serving. He got to keep a bunch of software, you know, on and on from that standpoint. The reason for that is, A, you know, maybe we're pretty good at dealing with buyers for businesses. But most importantly, we had another buyer right. buyer that offered more than $60 million.
Yep.
And when you have that confidence to push back on another buyer. Now it's the buyer's job to solve all of those problems that were reasons we wanted to go with the other group.
Sure.
And so at the end of the day, that's the, you know, that was the end result to that. Number one, you know, number two, I think you referenced it pretty well. A lot of business owners, founders, they focus on their business a lot. They focus on internal metrics. They focus on a whole bunch of things. And truth is, at the size that we deal with, which is usually in the 1 to 5 million EBITDA range, the biggest impact to their valuation may be something completely outside of their business that's being discussed right now in a conference room at a private equity group or a strategic buyer that will impact that valuation significantly. Mm-hmm. And so it's being aware of the market, being aware of who the buyers are, being aware of who recently missed out on an opportunity. And then, of course, knowing how to manage financials well so that you can make sure that the business is presented in the best possible light. I mean, and you know this, Joe, the buyer, it's not their first time doing a deal.
No,
not their first right. time submitting an LOI or working through working capital. Or, I mean, it is so easy to cover our fee just in, you know, a few areas, let alone all of them that, you know, that help create value.
Definitely. And look, I think, as you mentioned, this isn't a lot of the time the guys that we're selling these businesses to, you know, they do this for a living. So when it comes to what to put in a contract and, you know, how they can gain leverage against a seller, especially one that doesn't have representation and hasn't seen a contract like that before, they know every trick in the book. But at the same time, I think a lot of sellers forget that they have leverage too, right? They want to get rid of this. They want to sell their business, not get rid of, it's the wrong word. They want to sell their business. They want to sell, you know, monetize what they've created, cash in on probably their biggest asset. And there's a lot of pressure, I feel like, each one of them feel once they start getting into that situation to get the deal done and to not let anything go wrong. But what they sometimes forget to realize too is that they have a lot of bargaining chips, right? And you mentioned one, which is our job is to create competition in a lot of ways as intermediaries. We're meant to create competition. We're meant to go out and find multiple potential buyers in multiple different scenarios so that that seller has options. And as you mentioned, you can use those different offers as leverage against one another. But even with, you know, even within the circumstances, which is a business transaction, these buyers really want to get deals done. They want to buy good companies. There's a shortage of good opportunities out there for them. There's more competition than there ever has been, I think, in this world of buying businesses. So when they find something that's good, they're not going to make a horrible deal, but there's a lot of different levers you can pull to take leverage back to the seller, because these guys really want to get deals done. And a lot of them have capital that's been sitting on the sidelines for a long time. And when they see something they want, they're going to do whatever they need to do in order to get it done. And you can, if you know that as their banker, which you do, as you just described, there's a lot of ways you can come in there and not create hostility, but just, again, give leverage back to the seller and help them realize that, like, hey, we have negotiating chips too. This isn't a one-way street where they just get to beat us down. You know, we can really make this a lot more fair for you.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that buyers, quote unquote, have tricks. Here are two things I would say. Number one, most buyers, professional buyers, right? Private equity backed and the rest. Those guys want to pay market value for a business. Right. They don't create wealth by squeezing an entrepreneur by $500,000 or $1 million at the closing table. Mm-hmm. They create wealth by putting assets together, expanding margins, growing EBITDA, doing all of those things, right? So that part's number one. As they endeavor to do that, they will protect themselves on the downside. And so they'll want a lot of protections in deal structure. Mm-hmm. That, because, and you know this now we're talking about who's going to take the risk for certain things, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. as I mentioned about Mike, who's going to take a risk of the value of the equity 3 years from now? Who's going to take the risk as it relates to some of the software? Who's going to take, how much money should I have in escrow? What about reps and warrants, and how much exposure should there be? And for how long should there be? And quite frankly, I have to protect my shareholders and I have to protect my investors. So I want as much as I can get to protect them. That's what they're paying me to do. That's who I work for. Mm-hmm. Right. So mm-hmm. to your point, they absolutely, I think, will want a fair deal for the business. They mm-hmm. want a good partner to join them in the next leg of the business. But they also need to protect themselves on the downside. So now the conversation is, who should hold this risk? And when you can work on that together with the buyer and you start trading off risks that we can tolerate, but other risks that we don't want to absorb or we don't want to tolerate,
sure.
that's where you oftentimes will find common ground.
Yeah.
But it's super helpful. And buyers know this, that the likelihood of them getting a deal closed is something like 3 times greater when there's a banker on both sides.
Yeah, I believe because it.
You've got somebody that's been down the road before, knows what's appropriate, knows what's common, knows what's unusual. And that just helps in terms of making something work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I was sitting down with a, you know, very seasoned real estate, you know, commercial real estate broker recently. Guy's been doing this for 40 plus years. And it's funny to listen to him talk now because he works with some of the big, you know, Target is his client. Like whenever they were looking to open a new Target, this guy is the one kind of tasked to go find them those locations and then work through the leases and stuff like that. And he said that, you know, he's gotten to the point where he can kind of get to the table and tell these guys, like, look, we can put all this stuff in contracts and go back and forth for weeks and, you know, have all these different meetings, or we can just try to get, you know, to where we all know it's already going, which is like, I'm going to agree to this. You're going to agree to that. I'm going to agree to this. What do you think about this? And it is funny when you watch two professional deal makers in the middle, you know, whether the buy side banker, sell side banker, or private equity fund with a good sell side banker going back and forth, or even two deal attorneys who have been around the block. That's how they talk. You know, the meetings are much shorter and it's just like, all right, what do you think about this option? Yeah, we can do that. What do you think about this option? No, we don't really feel comfortable with that. Okay, we'll take on that risk. Like you're saying,
it's just— Why don't you feel comfortable with it? Okay, then we can do this and I understand. And it helps to understand why you're not comfortable or why you see it as a risk. Because mm-hmm. there might be other ways that we can satisfy that risk or that concern without giving you the thing you're specifically asking for if it's a, you know, a real impediment for us to get to a deal close.
Yep. So you mentioned you got a podcast called the Second Bite Podcast, and I know why you name it that, and I know what that means, but can you explain for our audience why, you know, what is the second bite of the apple? Why is that? And I guess explain, you know, to potential sellers out there who might be thinking that selling a business is like selling a house where you sell 100% of it and you move on. What is the second bite option? And why might it be something to strongly consider if you have even a little bit of gas left in the tank to keep going and running a company?
Yeah. So great question in there, Joe. So somebody, a second bite means when you do a transaction, there's three forms of currency, the way we view the world. Number one is cash, always our favorite. Number two is equity. Number three is earnout, right? They get, or seller note or something that's paid over time. And so when you, there are guys that maybe are starting to or thinking about selling their business now, or women founders that to your point still want to continue to drive and grow the business. As we like to say, our clients sell in order to accelerate, not to exit. They mm-hmm. want more resources, they want more clients, they want more capability, more sales, more distribution, whatever the case may be. So typically when we do a transaction, roughly speaking, 70% or so will be in cash, 20 or 25% will be in equity, and 5 or 10% will be in an earnout. The equity which is rolled forward, is often rolled forward without any tax consequence. And that is in the larger organization. When private equity does an acquisition, when they acquire a business known as the platform, it's the first business they buy, they will typically underwrite that business internally. They will think about that business, that they're going to grow, they're going to add other pieces to it, they're going to professionalize it. And for whatever they paid, if they paid $10 million for it, they're going to expect to exit somewhere around 40 or 50 or 60 million. Mm-hmm. So they expect that on their equity, they're going to do 4 or 5 times as a return. Mm-hmm. So if you sold them a business for $10 million and you got $7 million in cash and $3 million in stock, the hope is that the $3 million in stock will be worth 3 or 4 or 5 times that number at some point in the future. And now you, as the prior founder, have a significant and meaningful role in the future of that business, right? They Definitely. Have brought on a partner that brings a capability set to the larger business that they hope will be worth a lot more in the coming years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a beautiful structure because you can put some money in your pocket now, take some chips off the table, feel comfortable. The other thing about it too is a lot of the time these buyers want to put that founder and that CEO in a position where now they're focused solely on what they're best at and they build a team around them, you know? So as the owner of a small business, as you mentioned, where we usually sit is between that 1-5 million of EBITDA, anywhere from call it 10 to $100 million of value. And that 100 million is even big, but, in businesses like that, the founder, the CEO, the owner, even though they don't want to all the time, you know, when it comes to HR decisions or marketing decisions, or even what, you know, how much pizzas we should order on a Friday, like they're involved in those everyday decisions that like just can beat them down, wear them down, make them tired over a long period of time. And usually when these good buyers are coming in, they're saying, look, you have a specific skill set, Mr. Owner, that we think we can really leverage. You're really good at sales. You know, everybody in the industry, or, you know, maybe they're, this person knows a lot more businesses that they can go out and buy once they own this one. As you mentioned, they could build a platform around you. Why don't you focus your time, energy, and attention on that? And we'll just fill in the gaps around you so that, you know, the management team is empowered and they can, you know, make those decisions. And obviously you'll still be working there every day and be a huge part of the company, but you get to focus on what you just purely what you're good at and what you like to do and where you can add the most value. And now that creates a much better working environment for that owner too. So they've taken some chips off the table. They're doing what they want. They're getting paid to continue to do what they want. And they're potentially creating a lot more value, you know, with that remaining stock than they even were able to cash out the first time around. So that truly is a second bite. And it's oftentimes, as you alluded to, a bigger bite than the first one.
Yeah. And all of your points are well said and are true. You know, I grew up in the first half of my life as a financial advisor. Mm-hmm. And we often talked about the concept of dollar cost averaging. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the concept of waiting till 2030, because I'll be 70 that year and I'm going to sell the business then, is certainly more risky based on macroeconomics, microeconomics, world change, technology change, whatever the case may be, versus selling half of my business or 60% of my business in 2026 and the other 40 or 50%, you know, 5 years from now.
Absolutely.
Right? And when you're doing just the stuff you enjoy the most, maybe it's easier to go for a longer period of time. And I find that happens a lot with founders that are the sole owner, because mm-hmm. it's a big burden that they carry all by themselves. Nobody quite cares as much as an owner does. And now to be partnered with other people that have the same objective to get to a significant outcome, guys have fun doing that in that, you know, that second evolution.
Right. Yeah. You're not alone. And look at, I mean, just in the last 5 years, all these different things that can, without being completely out of our control, just destroy companies, whether it was COVID, whether it's tariffs today, you know, you see tariffs. We were talking, we just went and met Brian and I, took a drive down to Connecticut, met a great fund who's a partner of ours. And, you know, they own this awesome cabinet company and thing was spitting out cash, you know, doing like 12 million of EBITDA. That when they bought it, it was doing like four. They're killing it. And now these tariffs are like, if they stay in place and something gets signed where there's these 100% tariffs, the business is going to lose half its EBITDA like overnight. And that's crazy value. And it's nothing, the company did nothing new. They did nothing wrong. So my point in even bringing any of that up is I think if a good buyer is knocking at your door and interested, there's no wrong time to have that conversation because you can, like you are kind of alluding to, there's a lot of ways to create, you know, you might be like, oh, I could sell it in 5 years and I'll get X more dollars. It's like, well, you can create a situation for yourself now where you can take some of those dollars today, feel comfortable, put them into stocks or real estate or whatever you want to do, just hold it. And then do that, have that big cash out later, but you're de-risking, you know, that ultimatum of like having to sell it later down the road. It's just, and this is, these are things that I've just learned and seen through only through doing this, you know? So it's hard when you remove yourself and put yourself in the founder's shoes. It is hard to see what we're talking about right now. And I try to do that as much as I can.
Yeah, I think, yeah. And you're doing a great service from that standpoint, Joe. I think that I hear most often is, I didn't know you could do this. I didn't know I could sell and continue working and have more resources and, right?
Right.
So it's a nice alternative.
When did you decide to specialize in digital marketing and kind of tech-enabled services? How did you ultimately make that decision? And why did you go that route, right? You know, in some ways, I feel like some generalists might say, well, if I can sell a digital marketing agency, you know, I could sell a veterinary clinic or I can sell a roofing company. And
yeah.
I think that there's different, you know, some of the fundamentals remain true, but why did you personally decide to kind of stick in one lane and how has that paid off?
Good question. You know, for me, I like the people in the digital marketing space. I like the personality style. I like all the dynamics of those people, number one. Number two, after doing it for a long time, we've been doing it almost 20 years. I know a lot of the buyers and a lot of the sellers. I know what's going on in the space. I know who just missed. I know who just scored. I know who's looking to exit and who, you know, wants to, you know, reload, if you will. So it makes it easier for me to do a better job for a client that's looking for a certain outcome. And I also think I can give a more accurate read on where they are now and what their expectations are now. Because you know, these are all digital marketing transactions. And so as I like to say, my opinion is not all that important. It's not as important as what the market tells us. And when you study the same market every day over and over, you get pretty good at understanding the nuance to that. And oftentimes deals are won and lost in the nuance.
Definitely. When did you see the benefits of sticking with that in the sense of your referral network started to build up? You start to become known for, you know, hey, I have it might be a financial advisor or a CPA or a lawyer who has a client that owns a business and hinted at wanting to sell. And they say, oh, go talk to Todd. Yeah, because that's what he does in the digital marketing world. Yeah. Did it take a while to build up that reputation?
You know, it certainly does. Like any reputation, it takes a while. We're working on a TikTok agency, TikTok shop agency right now, because one of his best friends had an Amazon agency, Crush Amazon right there, that we sold earlier this year. We got a great result for him.
Sure.
That guy got referred to me from somebody that was in the conversion rate optimization space, and we did a great job for him. And so, you know, people talk. People, I think, feel a little bit more comfortable knowing that we know their business well, right? And if, for example, if you guys had done a dozen cabinet deals, you would know all the people in the cabinet space. And I think any cabinet manufacturer or finisher or distributor would probably feel better knowing that you know them.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I mean, it all makes perfect sense. And I think that, I could totally see, you know, we've been a slightly generalist just because most of the time we're working with buyers who are asking and looking for different things, tested different industries. But I do see, you know, technology has been the space that we've been in for the longest, and we've had the opportunity to, you know, we started on the buy side of technology, working with funds, finding them opportunities, meeting companies, building a relationship with those founders that, you know, last 3, 4, 5 years, and then having them come back to us and say, hey, I'm ready to sell. Are you still working with anybody that would buy me? We could say, maybe not right this second, but we know there's a lot of people out there that would buy you based on the fundamentals of your company. Why don't we help you with this transaction from start to finish? And we've started to see that snowball, you know, and again, you, from working with the buyers, you know who all the players are. As you mentioned, you know who might be looking for what, might have just bought a certain thing and are looking to build that platform and looking for great, you know, opportunities. And yeah, I think that there's something to sticking with something, you know, like you said, staying in a market for a long time, and you just really get to know it and specialize in it and create deal flow out of thin air by just doing a really good job for, you know, a extended period of time.
Yeah. And we don't, like you, you know, we don't serve buyers, right? Which you do. And so buyers want to go in different directions with different needs based on their portfolio companies and the rest. I'm, you know, as I like to, as I would describe it, you know, we do sell side only in the digital marketing space, 1 to 5 million of EBITDA. Mm-hmm. And if I do a really, really good job at that, my hope is that 5 years from now, I'll be doing sell side only digital marketing deals in the $1 to $5 million EBITDA space. Right. I don't want to go anywhere else. I don't want to do anything else. Yeah. I love the people we serve. I love the deals we help to, you know, create. So I'm, you know, content, happy, and excited about what we're going to do next.
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunity there. You know, there's a lot of opportunity there.
Sure is.
Have you seen the lower middle market M&A world change over the last maybe 24 months or so? And if so, maybe what should owners today be doing differently to prepare for the sale of their business?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's been some change just because of what you referenced before, right? There was a malaise with the last administration, and so there was uncertainty during the election. And so people slowed their roll from a marketing or an advertising standpoint. And so what happens is in Q1 of 24, I guess it would be, that was a bad quarter for a lot of people in the marketing space.
Yeah.
And for people that don't need to sell, my clients, but want to do something exciting, if they have a bad quarter over their trailing 12 months, I got to wait for that quarter to burn off.
Right.
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 So they did. And then you come into Q1 of 25, and now we got tariffs, which are creating uncertainty, and that slowed things a little bit. 25 has been a great year. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of excitement. There's lower regulation. Optimism is high. So, you know, we're the benefactor of a lot of that. And, you know, my suspicion is, in this space, people are always putting pieces together and creating opportunity. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we get a slight tailwind, sometimes a slight headwind, but our market space is pretty vibrant and always active.
That's great. Yeah, no. And I think that, you're spot on. I think this is, like I've alluded to it too earlier, these last 5 years have, you know, kind of taught a lot of people that there's so much going on outside of their control, and that focusing on controlling what they can control, which is within their, you know, maybe the four walls of, or the, you know, the, just the dynamics of their business. And again, understanding what's going on the macro level, how it might be influencing them, but,
One other thing I'd add, Joe. So we work with a lot of founders, and one of the things I tell them, and I have found this to be true over the years, is that if we go through a process, you're going to talk to 12 or 15 or 20 smart people, mm-hmm, that know the industry, mm-hmm, that have studied your business, that own a checkbook and don't care about your feelings. And they'll give you straight feedback on the business.
Right.
And you'll hear the same things over and over and over again. Right. And what you'll hear, I think, is we value your business at this number because, and this is the important part, because you guys do a little too much of this and you're not doing enough of that. And then there's the other thing, right? There's always the other thing.
No, yeah, yeah.
So now you and your partner look at each other and say, okay, if we didn't get the value we wanted, guess what we got to do? Couldn't be more clear. This, that, and the other thing. The yes. market has told us if we do this, that, and the other thing, they will value us greater. Mm-hmm. That is the best thing, the best consulting you could ever pay for. Right?
Absolutely. Yep.
That's number one. Number two, you might look at each other and say, Joe, do you have any idea how difficult this, that, and the other thing is? We're going to get this much more if we do this, that, and that just ain't worth it.
Right.
What I'd rather do is take a big chunk now and then roll some forward and see if that turns into something bigger.
Yeah.
So there is, in my opinion, no magical time that we're ready. Right. We did our financials right and we did all the ad backs and we converted from cash to accrual and now we're doing all that stuff. When the market favors you and you really feel like you are in the size range that you want to be, going to market, testing and learning from the market is the best way to make informed decisions. Because the other thing you'll do is you'll meet people that are in the space that are very smart, and you'll now learn what the other people in the space are doing. It's incredibly valuable.
Definitely. I think you can learn so much from going. There's really not a lot of downside, you know, to going to market. I think there can obviously be some downside if you accept an LOI and, you know, for whatever reason, spend a lot of time and then it gets broken. That's a whole different story. But going out to the market, seeing who's out there, seeing who wants to buy your business. I mean, me and you are going through one right now where we're working on together, where when we went to market, you know, because of the geography of a certain company, we just didn't really know collectively a lot of buyers that were looking in that geography, you know, the just based on where they are, dismissed it pretty early on. And that's nothing against the strength of the business. The business is performing excellently, but it's like one of those things where you're looking to buy a car, right? You know, once you decide on like, hey, I want to buy a black Jeep with black rims, you start to see them everywhere. So as long as we just started to stay in the market long enough to be like, all right, the only issue with this business today is that where it's located. So we just need to stay in the market long enough to find someone that is, doesn't look at that as a risk. And there's a deal to be had here if you can eliminate that. And it's the same, you were talking about a lot of financial stuff and, you know, in this particular case, you know, I think I learned a lot from your advice to that company, which is like, hey, keep doing what you're doing, which is growing and maintaining a really nice business. And I'll do what I do best and talk to buyers and find you guys some options. I just haven't done it long enough to do that yet. And sure enough, they're popping out of the woodwork, you know?
Yeah, we'll come across it for sure. And the time will be right. And, you know, we've got a great company here called Androck that we sold to Power Digital a couple of years ago. We had an opportunity to meet with them. We spoke to three groups, Joe. These guys do conversion rate optimization. We spoke to three groups. We got offers from three groups. They ultimately selected Power Digital. And it's been a tremendous, and to the point, Ned McPherson, who's also on the podcast, you can listen to him talk about it. He is now chief growth officer of a 700 person firm.
Wow.
And in January, he's going to be head of AI implementation for the same agency, right? Mm-hmm. The same for Power Digital, which is he's super excited about and something he never would have imagined for himself when he started down that road.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So he's got a bunch of stock. He's got some, you know, some cash in the bank. He's enjoying the work. Once you start to go down that road, once you start to see what some of the options, once you start to understand who's interested and why, it really allows you to think creatively about what do I want to do with the business that I have. So yep. It's certainly a pleasure to be able to provide that for the folks that we work for.
Absolutely. Well, look, Todd, I really appreciate your time here. I don't want to keep you too much longer, but this has been awesome. Thanks for, you know, again, the mentorship that you've had. Thanks for inspiring me to start my podcast back up. It was something I did 3-4 years ago and got kind of away from. And, you know, after going on yours and listening to yours and watching yours, I'm like, this is, you know, it's a great way to meet people. It's a great way to connect with people on a deeper level. And I'm happy I'm doing it. And I'm happy you could be a guest.
I am super happy I could as well, Joe. Best of luck to you and Brian. And thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much.